Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal form, the dawn of terrestrial.
Good afternoon, good evening, good whomever, good whatever, how I may find you. I'm Alan Avril, this is Agitators Anonymous, episode 180, possibly 190-something. We keep on moving towards the number 200. Well, today's podcast is indeed an interview, a chat, really. They're not really interviews, they're just sort of informal chats. But this is with Chris from High Spirits. He's done numerous projects over the years, Nightbringer, Professor Black, all sorts of other things, which we discuss during the podcast. In fact, we were meant to discuss a book that he's writing about Quorthon from Bathory, but somehow we never got round to it. High Spirits is, I suppose, not the typical, usual band, kind of band or kind of thing that I really listen to. It has elements of like pop woven into its heavy metal fabric that makes High Spirits stand somewhat alone. But me and Chris, as you can hear, share an awful lot of common ground and discuss loads of interesting things. And I think anyone who's seen High Spirits live will be able to attest to the fact that they bring this quotient of joy and sort of unbridled happiness. And watching the shit-eating grin on a friend of mine who had never even heard of them and was not really into metal who saw them, it's obvious to me that there's something more to High Spirits than the usual trad metal stuff going on. And look, Chris is a very interesting, competent and engaging conversationalist. And his list of musical achievements is as long as, you know, almost as long as James Plotkin, who I spoke to a while ago. So, Chris from High Spirits. So before we get into the episode, as ever, the podcast is sponsored by Metal Blade Records, the home of Primordial. So you can go to www.metalblade.indiemerch.com, I-N-D-I-E, metalblade.indiemerch.com, and you can use the code AA2024, and then you type 10% off, and you can get 10% off your order. It is the home of Show No Mercy, Hell Awaits, Cannibal Corpse, Fate's Warning, Merciful Fate, Primordial, tons and tons of bands, Cirith Ungol. The list is endless. Times are tough, and that 10% off can mean an awful lot. And this is the only metal label that is still independent. Right then. Now, back to the episode.
Recording in progress. So do you wish to be known as Chris or Professor Black? Which should I call you?
Just Chris is usually what works. I mean, in print, usually it's Professor Black. The professor nickname kind of started off as, I don't want to say as an insult, but it wasn't meant as a compliment. And I kind of had to claim it as my own to kind of reverse the power there. So Chris, we'll go with Chris.
Okay. But you are looking sort of like a floating sort of head of sort of ominous evil there in the, you know, with the, there you go. So yeah, you're certainly optically owning the moniker right now, I would say. You look like you're in some sort of deep space sort of, you know, craft.
Yeah, well, it's my studio. It's got, you know, diagonal kind of slanted ceilings, which is... which makes for terrible acoustics, but I suppose gives the right look for doing a podcast. I could maybe put some more light in the background.
Ah,
there, and you can see the sound treatments on the ceilings. There you go.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah. Well, and
not so mysterious as it looks, but
not so mysterious. You, I mean, people think I'm talking to somebody from Death's Bed of Mago or something, you know. So.
No, you might be. You don't know that.
Exactly. That's true. So what's the story? Most people know you from High Spirits and stuff, but I mean, yeah. a brief look on your, you know, discography of releases is kind of insane. You know, it's like huge. I remember speaking to James Plotkin a while ago, you know, OLD, you know, Canate and all that stuff, and his going through his sort of release. You know, the deluge of releases was insane. Yours is almost sort of similar. So when's the first one? When does it all kind of begin? Can you remember that?
Well, the first one is probably, I mean, if you don't count like high school band rehearsal tapes and things like that, then the first thing that was actually, a physical release was the Dawnbringer EP, which was called Sacrament. Which should have been a demo, but you know, when you're bound and determined to make a CD, you know, as a stubborn teenager, then you know, the CD is what you're going to get. Even though, like I said, it probably should have been a demo. It might have even been more successful as a demo. But that was 95 or 96. Hang on.
Oh.
96.
You have your entire discography just at hand. And 96. Okay.
Yeah, I've got copies in each room of the house, so no matter where we're talking, I can.
But that's. I mean, if you're stuck for something to, you know, to discuss, you can just reach one out and just tell whoever, what random visitor to the house, you can just start with the exact.
Yeah. Well, that would definitely not be the one to start anyone off on. But that's where I started, and. Yeah, to your question, that's 96, and then there was a full length by Dawnbringer in 97, which was much better. In terms of product quality, it wasn't a whole lot better, but musically it was a big improvement.
But you, I mean, what about the start then in Chicago and that kind of stuff? I mean, I've always been sort of fascinated by all that old school Chicago metal, which is everything from Master to Trouble to Cyanide to...
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Black Death. Is Black Death from Chicago? No, they're from Detroit.
No.
Right? All those kind of... Did you see
Black
those?
Black Death is from Cleveland.
Cleveland, that's it. Yeah. Did you see all those bands, or is that what you grew up with or around in that scene? Or
in 1978 in New Jersey on the East Coast.
Okay.
So... 80s, teenager during the 90s, and in the 90s I lived in Pennsylvania, and I didn't arrive in Chicago until the year 2000, so I missed all that that you were talking about. It was still a shock to me arriving and becoming aware of that history and of the just kind of it was a shock coming from where I grew up, coming here where there actually was a metal. I don't like the word scene. There was a metal community. There were people, you know what I mean? I probably had gone to 4 or 5 shows in my entire life, before I moved here. And then, this first 6 months or a year that I lived here, I just went completely crazy because there was a show, you know, every week of a band that I had heard of that, you know, I never could have seen, living where I lived before. And I after that, I kind of realized, oh, this is just normal here. I don't have to go to every single show that pops up because that band is going to come back in 6 months or 8 months later. And, you know, I don't have to. You know, it's not a fire drill. And that was just it was just very eye-opening for me again, to be in a place where this kind of music actually existed, where it wasn't just imaginary. It wasn't just, you know, me by myself ordering records in the mail and just kind of... heavy metal was, it went from being an imaginary personal thing to being a very real and collective thing, which again was quite a shock. It was overwhelming, and it was cool. It was cool. I mean, a heavy metal as a music already had its hooks in me. You know, I was already past the point of no return, you could say. But then to move here, it was just like, it was almost like that was the payoff. So you know, the history that you talk about, that's something that that you become aware of very quickly. You mentioned Cyanide, became yeah. friends with those guys. That they were still a going band. Eric Wagner was back in trouble for a year or so around when I came back, so I did get to see.
Okay, Simple Mind condition maybe, kind of, or something like
no, that. No, it was after that. It was a little bit after that. I don't know if they did an album together, but I definitely saw a few gigs. Sure, okay. You know, with that full lineup, Ron Holzner was still in the band too, and the Chasm is another band very much
great band, very much, really great band, yeah.
And they were very much still kind of on the rise when I arrived. You know, around 2000, I got to see Scepter before they broke up.
Scepter, yeah.
I'm happy about that. Usurper was still kind of in their original form. I think they were just in the process of moving from Necropolis to Earache at the time, so very much still in the thick of their career, if you want to put it that way. So I missed the kind of Master and E-Trope, and the, you know, kind of the original arc of Trouble. I missed all that by a lot, by a decade probably, but you know, it's a huge city. There's always going to be bands here. There's always going to be activity. It expands and contracts a little bit, you know, year to year, like anywhere else, I would say. Mm-hmm. But just the population size and the immigrant population size has a lot to do with it too, because you know, it's very, very, very multinational, very dedicated. Lots of support for the different genres within the genre, you know.
And now compared to how it was 20 years ago, I mean, what's going on now? We talked a little bit about this before, I think in a vague dispatches before, about the small to great changes, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years, especially post sort of lockdown changes in the scene and stuff. Maybe they're different. Obviously, in Dublin is a smaller place, so the microcosm of it is maybe a bit more profound. I'm not really too sure, but compared to when you first moved there, do you still go to shows and stuff like that?
I do not, you know, certainly not in the, I'm not binging like I was in my 20s when I first got, you know, and shows wasn't the only thing I was binging on at that age, believe me. But that's a hard question to answer, because I have a different vantage point now than I did back then. I mean, back then I was working at a store called Metal Haven, which was actually one of two at the time dedicated heavy metal record stores in the city.
Do they still exist?
No. The owner still does business. He still does business online and at record fairs, like people do. But you know, rent for a retail store is just
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, there's it's impossible, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we were talking about before. That I mean, even just, you know, you can say what you want about gentrification of cities and all that kind of thing, but one of the sort of main parts of local stores and small businesses moving on is the insane increase in rents. And like, we'd have no rock bars or metal bars here anymore. We have one shop, you know, hanging on. But when you have a city center which has less and less traffic through it, and people are remote working and stuff, then you don't have many drop in customs. And so it has a knock on effect to there being not really a scene. But if we're probably roughly about the same age, then maybe we had our scene days. Maybe that's sometimes how I think of it, even though it's a bit, maybe that's a bit depressing for somebody who's 20 years younger, who's supposed to be inheriting it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's a question for that for that younger person. And I will say that having gone to some shows recently, I definitely noticed a younger crowd. The large, put it this way, it's like I don't know these people. Like I don't recognize these faces. Yeah. And that I have mixed feelings about that. One feeling is that you know, fuck, I'm old. but then the, you know, kind of the positive side to that is like, you know, the music is going on. You know, there are people joining the audience is growing. You know, maybe not at a fixed rate. You know, like I said, things expand and contract year to year. You can't expect anything that's organic to have a you know, a constant.
It also depends on I think it depends on the band as well. I mean, if you go and see Kate, there'll be a lot of older dudes and Polish and South Americans here. Whereas if you go and see Gate Creeper or Blood Incantation or, you know, something like that, you'll get, you know, teens and 20 somethings. I think it also depends on the band.
No, but you're absolutely right.
Considering that, though, what I find interesting is then your musical history and the longevity of it. But the High Spirits thing is a kind of reasonably recent thing. So then how did you morph into going through, you know, starting with something more, you know, extreme to ending up in High Spirits playing a sort of older fashioned style of music, but a kind of newer band? I mean, does High Spirits come into that bracket of having a younger audience then? Or do you find yourself standing there in front of people who are 15, 20 years your junior? Or I don't know, you know, does it tie into
it? It's really, really mixed. And especially as time has gone on, we find that the High Spirits live audience is very mixed in terms of age, in terms of the types of shirts and the way people are attired. I would say in the beginning, closer to the beginning years of that band, it was all very very typical, you know, patch vest, long hair, you know, what you would see at the, you know, the German festivals. As time has gone on, and I think maybe more in the US, but not only in the US, we see a lot more diversity. Again, with the style of dress, the age range, our shows in the US, it can be 50-50 guys and girls, which is great. You know, I mean, that's what we want. We want to be everyone's band. We want to be the band that you're allowed to like, no matter where you come from, right?
Well, that's one of the things that I did notice, and one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, it's written, scribbled on my pad, is that the couple of times I've seen High Spirits, it seemed to me that there was rarely a band so aptly named, so to speak, in that the tropes of traditional heavy metal, which sometimes alienate people who maybe didn't grow up on the Maidens or the Priests or whatever, or also, as you say, the denim vest sort of keep it true, deaf forever people. High Spirits sort of couldn't step sideways, you know, step out of from all that kind of stuff. And there's, I think I'm, what was that, one of the shows with a friend of mine who was more like black metal but never listened to heavy metal, and she just enjoyed the hell out of it, like just really just had this, she's like, this is great fun, which she wasn't going to get from you know, like, you know, kind of the mustachio high cheekbone Swedish stuff. She was a bit like, this doesn't do much for me after a song or two. But so it always struck me that there was something there when I first heard, you know, Another Night in the City or whatever. They're like, oh, here's a band who could, is taking some of the things that I've, I like from Dokken and from 80s hard rock, that sort of uplifting thing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a kind of Maiden, you know, kind of twin guitar nerdiness, so to speak, even though it had that as well. But do you know what I mean?
I do. And it's not as... I do know what you mean, and I agree, but it's not as intentional as that may sound. It's very much I feel the best of the High Spirits stuff, the best songs and albums tend to be the ones where I've just kind of opened the gates and just written the songs that I was in the mood to write. You know, thinking less about like, oh, let's emulate this particular genre, or maybe try a riff that I heard on such and such album yesterday. It's very much, you know, of course, all that seeps in subconsciously, as you know, as a songwriter. You know, you can't shut yourself off to your influences, but you can, I think, open your mind to letting a song kind of come alive on its own, and let the song kind of dictate the process more than any of your own intention. As far as the way people experience the band live, I think that's it's always a little weird to talk about High Spirits, because there's kind of almost two bands, or two kind of parallel things happening with. I sometimes think of it as being two bands with the same repertoire, okay. because as you probably know, in the studio it's just me. You know, I'm writing and recording everything on my own. Okay. The rest of the band doesn't hear the album until it's finished. You know, until it's
okay.
So,
is there a reason for that? Like, why do you do it like that?
That's how it started, and I don't want to mess it up. I don't want to. No, seriously, that's how we're. It wasn't planned that way. It just kind of happened that way. And some other guys in the band might answer differently, but my answer is that I don't want to, you know, we have a formula, we have a way of working that has worked for us both on album and as a live band. And we don't wish to stray from that, you know, and risk tipping the balance.
And do you not find that, I mean, for me, I'm not a man who has much patience in the studio. I enjoy the procedure to a degree. I enjoy this. My phone is ringing. Fuck off. I enjoy it to a point. Well, my patience tends to wear thin after two or three. Tin. 33 and a third. It begins to wear thin after like two or three hours of like, I have to go pop, 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 pop. And some of the vocals are just one take. Fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm not
first
interested.
Blood.
Yeah, and so the, you know, picking over endless kind of things, somehow this alters the spontaneity of heavy metal.
It does.
And that's sort of, I mean, do you have a band that you rehearse where you make noise with?
I do, yeah. I have a Motorhead cover band that play a lot. And we've done some various shows with as kind of like a Professor Black solo band where we either do Motorhead or some stuff from my older bands. So I do. But the High Spirits stuff does not go through any kind of rehearsal room vetting or workshopping. That's pretty much me in my chair over there. Doing the process you just described, but trying to preserve that spontaneity. And I think you're right that the vocals are an opportunity to do that, to kind of any kind of spontaneous energy that's been drained maybe from the rhythm tracks by that process, you can kind of inject it back in there with the persona of the vocal.
Like, I mean, I make some stuff on GarageBand and make some songs and fiddle about with stuff. But at the same time, sometimes I like the idea of like, if I come into, like, Primordial hasn't changed in 32 years. We rehearse exactly the same way as we did in 91, only it's a phone in the middle of the room, not an old cassette recorder. And it's exactly the same. We've done it on purpose to be like, we can't be a band who's are sending files to each other, I've learned this riff and put something over this, because that removes the human process of the band that was the reason why we started. Now, of course, if you've started High Spirits as this thing you do on your own, do you never get the impression, though, sometimes you're going like, is this a fucking good idea, or what the fuck? Sometimes you need somebody to go, come on, what the fuck are you talking about, you know?
And that'll happen once in a while, and I guess it has happened a few times that I'll send something out to somebody and be like, you know, let me know, am I on the right track here, or you know, does this work for you? But 99% of it happens in isolation, and maybe I'm stupid for doing it that way. Maybe that's a huge time waste, because it's definitely true that, and I'm sure you've been there too, that you try something, you have it one way, and then you try it 99 other ways, and
I think
and
that
you're back where you started, and you know it's like that Control Z key is a crutch sometimes.
I mean, I feel like I have a thing where I mess around where I just recorded like like super lo-fi black metal, and I just make sometimes riffs like that and mess around with that. But what I think maybe I would miss without the human process is the dynamics of the sound, where the drummer might ease off in kind of a Brian Downey style floor tom roll instead of ducka 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 ducka. So you miss the 70s modulations or 80s modulations of the sound, where somebody might do, you know, snare roll, like military snare roll on the fucking flam or whatever. Look, here's me thinking I know about drum techniques. You know what I mean? Like, and then, or the bass might change, or, you know, I might not play as hard. And so if I only did Dread Sovereign like that, I have a feeling it would be very linear in a frequency range. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because
those are the dynamics that you get from other people playing. I mean, that's the worry I would have with heavy metal. In trying to put what you're doing, you know,
and I think that's where the pop aspect of High Spirits comes in, because it is very.
That's what I was trying to put my finger on before. That's what it was.
Yeah. And I don't think that's I'm not put off by the term at all. I think High Spirits is very pop, and a lot of that does reside in the production technique, which is you know, kind of like you described. It is not. It's not dynamically flat, but there's a certain snugness to it that comes from one person playing all of the instruments. Maybe I'm wrong, but to my ear, it suits that kind of music and kind of plays to the kind of like pop appeal that I would hope the songs have. But, you know, again, that goes back to saying like I want this band to be for everybody. I mean, I know, I accept that it's not going to be. I know that's impossible, but part of that again is that production value, that production technique, and really tightening down all the screws. You know, live, it's a different story. You know, it's a much more of a you know, high intensity rock and roll show where there's going to be give and take. There's going to be mistakes and you know, things done spontaneously too. So it can be, like I said, it can be hard to talk about High Spirits and kind of bouncing between what that means for a recorded album and what that means for the live show, because it can be two different things.
Maybe you can speak to this, because I know fuck all about pop music. I mean, except what I hear incidentally, I don't listen to any, or, you know, I mean, of course, I knew what my sister would listen to in the 80s and the 90s, whatever. But I was listening to some producers talking on a podcast, and they were saying that the difference, like, pop music has become so sonically expansive, like it's become this huge sound compared to how tinny or simplistic it was in the 80s or the 90s. And I was listening to this person discuss, you know this band Sleep Token. Now, it's like a new heavy metal band. Of course, they wear masks and et cetera, et cetera. But they were talking about Sleep Token specifically. It sounded like Tool-ish, kind of like ish. I didn't think it was terrible. But what I did notice was the super pop production on the vocals. The vocals were treated like, I'm going to say the name Drake, even though I don't quite know what that means. But what they were trying to explain was, they were almost treated like the way hip hop or pop vocals were treated, which is something metal never goes near.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know what I mean? And that their general tones and sounds of this, whatever happened in the early 2000s, the pop music took on this huge, low-endy, expansive production. And I have noticed that, at least from an outsider's perspective, like, oh, pop music sounds different to, like, that. I mean, obviously, than it did in 1992 or 1996. But talking about the popularity of this band Sleep Token, with young people, and they're fucking huge. Their last album is the most streamed metal album on Spotify last year.
Oh wow!
I don't even know where they're from. I don't know anything about them. They're just a couple of people have linked it to me and gone, "What the fuck is this?" And I go, "Actually, oh, okay." But what it's the vocal thing that really stuck out to me is maybe it's someone then who knows more about pop you might have an opinion on that or speak to that. Do you know what I don't
hold myself out as an expert on the
sure,
the
but modern... you might know more than me.
No, it sounds like I don't actually. If I haven't even heard this.
Well, okay, but it's not necessarily about no one sleeps talking, but you know what I mean about the vocal production, the style, whatever that is, you know.
I don't really know. My concept of pop music is kind of embedded in me from the 80s when I was a little kid, before metal, before I even knew that there were genres of music. You know, there was like classical music that my parents listened to, and then there was everything else, you know, that might be on the radio, or you might hear, you know, on the PA in some, you know, public space or whatever. And so this was 84, 85.
Sure, okay, yeah.
Mid-80s, you know, again, as a little, like single-digit age little kid.
Yeah.
So I think my concept of pop music comes from those times, you know, and I don't even know what the, you know, sometimes I'll hear a song now, I'll be like, oh yeah, that's a good song. I don't necessarily know the name of the song or the artist or whatever, but I like those production values where there's a really strong rhythm track, where the rhythm track is kind of differentiated. Like you can hear there's the bass drum and the snare doing one beat, and then you've got like an entire like top layer of percussion kind of.
What would be an example of that? Something like The Weeknd or something, you know?
The one that comes to mind, and I know it because my son, when he was 2 years old, was completely obsessed with the song Material Girl by Madonna.
Okay, yeah,
If you listen to that, that has a slamming drum track, and there's again, there's like there's the main beat or whatever, the rhythm of the song that's existing kind of on the bottom, and then there's a whole like, it's like the frosting on the cake, you could say, like with what the hi-hat does, and then there's some other like little percussion sounds in there. So I think of that. I think of the amount of reverb that is typical on 80s mixes, and that was a thing in metal too. I mean, listen to Transcendence by Crimson Glory.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That has in my concept, that's an example of a metal album that's got also a very kind of
almost
production to it.
Just as an aside, we played some gigs one weekend with Crimson Glory, must be like 10 or 11 or 12 or something, when they came back for a while, and we played just after them. It was like Immortal, I think, or something else as well, and we started and our sound engineer was like, what the fuck is going on? And he realized that they turned off the bass bins of the PA.
Oh, cool.
All under the stage was just all the bass bins where they just turned them off, like something he just never even heard of, because that's their their like high-pitched kind of trebly sound. And I just heard after about 40 seconds, like the whole bass bins coming on under my... I was like,
well, that's cool. That's definitely something that happened in the 90s, that whole kind of like low end fixation when the bass drum became the kick drum. You know, it's like, I wish we could go back to that moment in time. It's like, no, it's not the kick drum, it's the bass drum, please. You know, I think that's like this little, I don't know. There's a little marker there, I think, of certainly in live concert mixing, but also in album production, the low end fetishism that kind of came around in the 90s. It's like,
I mean, one of the things that somebody was saying to me about pop music now is that the songs are getting shorter and shorter. They're now reverting to late 50s, early 60s time limits, 210, 220, 225.
And is that true?
Yeah, that's what they were saying. And that they hit very often the chorus first, because kids haven't got the patience to get through the verse to get to the chorus, you know?
Yeah. That's a good one. That's a good technique that I've tried a few times. There's one Pharoah song that comes to mind that we did the chorus first, but
Living After Midnight, isn't it? So
Living After Midnight does it. Yeah.
There's a few others, yeah, but it's generally, but it's just something I've been, it's weird, I sort of pay attention to, or at least observe people talking about lots of pop music. I won't necessarily go and listen to it then, but I did notice, like I said, the vocal thing with Sleep Token. Somebody went, that's the way vocals are treated in pop music, and that's why, one of the reasons why it's so popular, because it's not a, like a heavy metal, a hard rock voice. It's got this, whatever this is, this lush, wide, you know, production on the vocals. But yeah, it seems to be the pop music songs are getting, reverting back to like Love, Love Me Do type time length, you know?
That's cool. I mean, it's hard to, do what I do in under 3 minutes.
Certainly I can't do it.
Right. I've come in, I think there are two High Spirit songs that are under 3 minutes. This Is the Night might be right around 3 minutes, but there's one called Reminding You of Me, which doesn't even really have a chorus. That's a fun method too, to try to write a song that doesn't even really have a chorus. I mean, that it's hard to do, because there's usually, even in those kinds of songs, there's usually like a payoff line at the end of the verse that, like, you could argue, okay, that's the chorus. But
Well, we with Primordial made a whole, I mean, the album Journey's End, which is 97, I don't think there's a chorus on the whole record in any song.
Really?
It's just, and it's almost all kind of open chord stuff. Very odd. And then slowly but surely I began to go, the influence of the Manowars and the Priests and stuff began to permeate what we're doing. I realized, like, I don't have any choruses. Like, by album three, there was like one, maybe two. There were just structures of songs. And I thought, we've got to maybe have some kind of chorus.
The more you play live too, you gain experience as a live band, and you realize that those are the moments that are easiest for people to grab onto.
I think you have to go from being part poet to part rabble rouser to part sort of like hooligan on some level between things. And so if you want the hooligan terrorist chant, it's back to you. You're gonna have to fucking write one. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
The first couple of albums we didn't write fucking any, and then Pardon was like, okay, we can't keep doing the same thing. We have to move on to doing that, which is sort of unusual, because I think a lot of people went the other way around. But to make an album with no choruses, which is themes, but that's because we're doing this sort of drifty pagan cinematic whatever it was, you know. But the more heavy metal it became, the more I became you know, interested in putting in choruses. But if you're going to start with what High Spirits is, then you've got to think of the chorus, you know.
I mean, totally.
it's fucking hard. It makes the genius of the Ramones and the Misfits like fucking 50 times more fucking powerful when you understand how fucking hard it is, you know? To make an earworm, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's something you get better at. I mean, I worked with a band called Noctmystium for a while, kind of as an outside songwriter, or inside songwriter, I guess. I was never really a member of the band, but I did a lot of jobs. Within the band nevertheless, and one of them for a period was, you know, I wrote the lyrics and kind of arranged the songs, you know. They would say, here's this pile of riffs, and we do like a pre-production thing of recording all the riffs, and I'd take it home and piece it all together into a song. Be like, all right, here's the chorus, and put the lyrics on it. And I think I think that was really effective, even for what that band was doing musically. I think it was really effective to kind of, like you said, put the hooligan part out there for people to kind of latch onto, and
throw the Living After Midnight terrorist chant out there.
It's just, you know, you want the audience to participate. You want to keep them engaged. I mean, that's the name of the game, right? So
that must be, we were going to talk a bit about Noctmystium, but that must be, I'm a big fan of those, you know, well, nearly all of it, to be honest. But being the sort of external songwriter, I suppose, does it come with less pressure then?
Totally. That was, you know, you know, because I was also kind of the guy recording, to a point. I was actually the guy kind of producing the albums. You know, I was bringing my, you know what an ADAT is? Those old digital 8-tracks that Alesis made. Yeah, I had a couple of those. So I would, for the early Noctmystium, not the very earliest Noctmystium stuff, but starting with Demise, I would bring my little mixer and my ADAT over to, you know, to wherever, and, you know, mic up the drums, and that's how we made those albums.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah. So, you know, as I said, I played a number of roles in that band over the years. But to your question, yeah, there was a lot of opportunity to kind of experiment, even whether with a recording technique or a songwriting method or even a vocal technique pilot that in a Noc Mystium session. And I can actually give you a few examples. There's a Noc Mystium song, Nightfall, which is on Addicts, that's got kind of a, you know, kind of like a Misfits-y kind of moody chorus, sort of Nightfall, with like a, you know, a couple of harmonies on there. I don't remember whether I sang it or part of it, but I definitely wrote it. And I was like, oh, that sounds cool. And then there's a High Spirit song called Running Home, which was just on a, it's just like a 7-inch B-side. It's not, you know, one of the more popular songs, but it does have pretty much exactly that same method of singing with where the chorus comes in. So that's one example of something that's like, oh, that seemed to work pretty well over here. Maybe it'll work just as well with what I'm doing. So yeah, there was a lot of, it's me, it was my energy kind of going out into these different projects.
Which I think is like, that's the more like, that is the more, role of more like a traditional 80s producer, you know.
Yes.
Trying to explain to somebody now when there's no physical sales about points and that kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
If I can try and butcher it by explaining, but like say Michael Wagner would produce an album in the 80s and he got like a point, which meant, I think if you got 1.5 points, which meant you got a very small portion of the sales. But of course, if the album sold 1.5 million copies, you might make a couple of $100,000. So if you were a huge big name producer and you got points on everything, you could make residuals on sort of on the sales, you know. Is that the right, that's, you know what I mean? But they were involved in the songwriting and the, you know, the structuring and all that stuff. You know?
That's correct. And to add that they got paid from the first sale. It wasn't it was not like the artist's royalties, which were delayed until after the budget recouped. The producers started getting paid from the first sale.
Crazy when you think about it, but yeah, I mean, some of them, the big ones are just moving from album to album. If you did 4 or 5 big ones a year, if you you're making fucking millions as the producer, you know.
And a lot of them were not technical people. A lot of them were musical people, but very often there would be a studio with an engineer or a staff of engineers who were actually doing the technical work of making the album, and the producers were just kind of these these overseers with the with the more creative role, and also kind of setting the threshold for what the technical demands, what the technical standards let's say would be for an album. And it's funny to look back at Nachmystium. Originally I was kind of the engineer. Yeah. It was the music was coming from the other guys. I made my suggestions or played my little guitar noodle here and there or whatever, but I was mostly the guy who had the mixer and the ADAT and knew how to mic up a drum kit. Yeah. And as time progressed, they signed to Century Media. The budget, increased by a factor of 10, yeah. Which is when they hired in Sanford Parker as an engineer. And it was at that point that my role was no longer technical. My role kind of flipped to the other side of that, yeah, that producer term. And I became, like you said, more like an 80s producer, or like more like a hip hop producer, I think, in my, yeah, my concept, like somebody who kind of sets the, the creative frame record. And that was really fun. But there was, can only get so far in that environment.
Yeah. I mean, we've done things where we've recorded in the old Academy studios in Yorkshire. And Mags, who was a great guitar player, a great musician, a very influential guy, the engineer, every now and again, he'd turn around and go, why don't you try this to that? And you go like, oh, okay. And then you'd sit on it. And like, he was the first person who went, lads, you just can't be using those guitars here. You need to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
But the influence of being able to just go, well, why don't you go to this different key or something? I always liked the idea of producing records, but somehow never quite fell into it, even though I've sort of contributed lots of other things to other to other projects or whatever. I mean, I did a project with my cousin called April Men, which is just like electronic music.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I have to say that was really interesting because for the first time having to sing over the dynamic the frequency range of guitar is just taken out. So you're only singing over the bass or keyboards, and then every inflection of the voice is super scrutinized. And it made me really appreciate the people I was trying to ape with it, which were like Brian Ferry, or channel a little bit of Bowie, or whatever I was trying to channel a little bit of. I was like, fucking hell, every single, which is lost sometimes in a wall of guitar.
Yeah.
Made me appreciate the genius of Roxy Music, like fucking profoundly,
Yeah, well, I think producer is a very elastic term, or a very relative term, like we've been talking about. There's, everything from, like, oh no, you can't use those guitars, or, to like, say, no, we're cutting this part out of your song entirely. And there's nothing you can do about it because that's my mandate from the record company. I don't think you and I have been in many situations like that, but for some bands that is the situation. It's like,
I mean, it's certainly, I think, because of the sort of downsizing of rock and metal, so to speak, that sort of, it's like a job that just kind of got squeezed slightly out, or you had to produce yourself, or somebody was willing to produce for next to nothing, because there's no such thing as points anymore on.
Or you have an engineer who's kind of the shadow producer, even though that's,
Yeah. And so, like, I mean, take for example that, like, you must have tried to sing over stuff like that, which doesn't have guitars on it. It's sometimes quite a daunting prospect without that wall behind you of the frequency range. I mean, the pop influence of High Spirits, have you tried to actually just make, let's say, pop music or pop, High Spirits without the guitars?
Well, the closest I've come was with a different project actually called Actor. Which I don't know if you're familiar with Actor. It's me and two of the guys from a band from Finland called Circle. Well, and they have a zillion other projects too. But
I was familiar with it. I thought it was a bit more sort of proggy. Would that be not the wrong word?
Yeah, I don't honestly. It's always.
I don't really know what that word exactly means, but that's what sort of popped into my head.
Yeah, I mean, those are these terms that kind of mean different things to different people too. And being someone who pretty much only listens to hard rock and metal, I am always kind of grasping for ways to describe music outside of those frames because, I just don't have the vocabulary, right?
Yeah,
but,
sure.
But with Actor, the rhythm guitars are, let's say they start out with a certain importance, But by the end of the process, they're pushed pretty far back to where you don't even really know that they're there anymore. And I don't remember experiencing it at the time of making those albums, but now when I go back and listen, I can hear exactly what you're talking about, how there are certain nuances of the voice that it's like, you shouldn't even be able to hear that. You shouldn't even be able to hear maybe that I'm not controlling 100% of my delivery. I know what you mean. I don't feel like I've hit that point with High Spirits, although there is always that shock because I record everything, regardless of what project we're talking about, I record everything very, very raw in my studio. I don't even compress the vocals going in. It's like the mic, and then I have a preamp to just like add some gain to it. And then it goes straight onto the computer from there. So there is always, when I send something out to be mixed, and those first mixes come back, and I kind of hear everything. And it's not just the vocals, but especially the vocals. You kind of hear the engineer has kind of cleared away all the brush and all the debris that's in there, and kind of really sharpened the instruments. And there's always that shock of like, whoa, is that what it's really sounded like? Oh my goodness!
I've often sometimes undone things that were too tight. Too proper. I've kind of gone in and gone, that doesn't sound like something I'd do if somebody's tried to push me into that. But we did with the April Men thing, we did Love is the Drug and New Year's Day. I mean, I like some really old early 80s U2, but certainly having to sing New Year's Day gave me a sort of a grudging respect for the vocals of Bono. And certainly watching him sing, there's a footage of him doing Unforgettable Fire vocal sessions, and you go, this dude could sing in Iron Maiden, actually. He has a bellowing voice, you know. But you know, singing the metal thing, I've always sung at a very loud volume, very intense all the time. And then to actually have to pull it back like a lot.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Control it when it's, you know, like when you're not going full pelt.
It's not easy.
Yeah, no, it wasn't easy at all.
That was, we experienced that in a band I was in until recently called Pharaoh. Our singer was just world class.
Class,
super talented dude, just like all power, like great, great character to his delivery and everything, until we tried to get him to sing clean. And then it was always like, we would do, you know, it ended up being, you know, do 20 takes of it and then comp together the best, you know, go line by line and comp it together because he was just not consistent, you know, like we've been talking about. You have to really have control of your delivery to be able to convince people to really sell the song. And even a guy like that with you know, pretty much unlimited power as a heavy metal singer, it's like, yeah, well, you know, we kind of wanted to put an acoustic part here, but I don't know if you know. So
20 takes would have me gone to the pub already after about 5 or 6 or 7 tops, maybe. Pharaoh, that was, I mean, there's one album which I know that is kind of like revered as some sort of sacred text by power metal fans. What's that one?
Yeah, it's probably, that's The Longest Night. That's the second album. It seems to be the one that has the most staying power. Although I like them all. I mean, that's definitely when we were still more, definitely got more technical as we went on. The song arrangements and the musicianship kind of leveled up album to album. And that being the second album, not that there was anything primitive about those songs, but it was still very more power, less prog.
Yeah. And what about then the last High Spirits album? Because I noticed that was kind of, you know, when you flick through, say, the last issue of Death Forever, I noticed it's kind of in some of the, you know, writers' lists and that kind of thing. High Spirits still seems to have a sort of love affair with that sort of Death Forever crowd, you know?
I think so.
Even though you kind of sidestepped it a little bit, as we talked about, I could imagine that being more so in the USA than in Europe, perhaps.
What do you mean?
As in that sometimes when it comes to the, you know, let's call it, for a better word, the keep it true crowd, you're within that, you're within that sort of sphere of that crowd. It can sometimes harder to have more, let's say, diverse bills as you might have in the USA sometimes.
Oh, I see.
With that traditional heavy metal crowd, you know, I found it like, I'm kind of been in it and been out of it and been in it and been out of it, and sort of found it to be, I like it, of course, but it can sometimes be, I'm not sure what the word I'm searching for is, a little bit difficult to sidestep, maybe is the right way to say it.
Mm. Well,
I'm not sure I phrased that right, but you know what I mean, maybe.
I do know what you mean. I think there's a conservativeness, maybe among...
Maybe that's the word I'm searching for, you know?
I think a stubbornness, a conservativeness, that...
Two words I like sometimes, you know, in certain contexts.
That right, and...
An orthodoxy to it, you know?
Yeah, that's probably the best word that we've had so far, but there's... I don't know. As I've gotten older, I can look back and see that there were times when I was overly conservative or overly orthodox. I mean, they're just hangups, right? You make your mind up about things when you're younger, everything's going to be this way and not that way. And, you know, you kind of set down these guidelines or rules for yourself. And I think maybe that, that touches on what you're talking about. And as I'm thinking about it now, it seems like it's like the bell-shaped curve, maybe. You have the very young, say like the 20-something crowd, and then you have the very old, say the 60-something crowd, who are the maybe the most diehard conservative, orthodox, whatever word you want to use, the most fixed, and I think it's the bell in the middle, maybe, who are more open-minded, and we're generalizing here, and I'm, you know, it's not something I've thought a lot about, honestly, you know, when we have people at the show, I'm just glad there's people at the show.
I might be completely wrong in those observations. It's just I think what I'm trying to sort of put my finger on is that I've noticed in the last 5 or 10 years, the sort of social media years, the reinvention of alternative cultures, or as we would call them, which includes heavy metal, punk rock, all these kind of things, or goth. Like for a long time, goth, you go to a Sisters of Mercy show and you could see it was like going to go and see Udo or something like this. But lately, the sort of new electronic Boy Harsher has brought some people in, you know, culturally, things have shifted and changed a bit more to that God seems to make more sense, maybe perhaps to younger people. And sometimes you go to a particular like a metal show and I'm struck by like, well, we're death metal is middle age now, you know, like it's getting old. Are there young people coming in to breathe new life into the scene? What are the reasons why? And maybe it speaks more to, I think maybe a sort of pheric or complete socio-cultural anthropological, what do you want to say, victory of pop music, at least in the mainstream, which has pushed these things to the periphery, and that young people don't resonate with alternative cultures the same way. It's a rather complicated way of what I'm trying to sort of consider and how I was trying to frame high spirits within it with the sort of pop references when we talked in the last part. But sometimes I go to shows and I look around. I'm very interested in watching the crowd, you know, like sort of looking at what are the demographics, how are they all split now? Because I remember them from 30 years ago, you know, and I'm sort of, tell me to stop, because that's sort of what I'm trying to get my finger on, you know?
No, like I said, it's not something I think about a lot. But what I have thought is, you mentioned the social media age, the YouTube age or whatever. And my feeling, which may be different from yours, is that because of the connectivity of the internet, and because of the accessibility of, music, video streaming, and that I feel that in terms of countercultures, I feel like everything that's ever been popular in the history of pop is popular now, because of those mechanisms that allow the audience to organize and connect and participate. They may still be countercultures. They may still be of limited sizes, but I think the digital economy or whatever you want to call it, the digital anthropology of it all, is sustaining it, and will continue to do so. I think if we look at the totality of subculture, musical subculture, film, other art forms, I think yes, there will always be a sub to the mainstream, but I think within that kind of blob of subcultures, I think everything that's ever been popular is popular right now, and is likely to stay that way.
That's a sentence I'd have to think about. Everything that has been popular is popular right now. I mean, we could argue that heavy metal is less popular than it used to be in the 70s and the 80s, but yet bands still fill festival. It's wild because festival culture and heavy metal is about as healthy as it could possibly be. There's more of heavy metal festivals and rock festivals than everything. But yet at the same time, if you were to look at the top 500 streaming artists on Spotify, you would find no new heavy metal.
No, it's true. And there are so many different ways. There are so many different ways to measure popularity. And I'm using a very abstract and kind of soft way of measuring it. Festival culture, and just like these, it just seems like fan culture, it seems, is very active.
I sort of feel the same way in that the amount of the different metrics can be confusing. I mean, the optical metric, for example, walking around Dublin, or let's say me and my friend were sitting in the park there, and it happened to be a day when I guess kids were coming out from an exam. And there were thousands of kids in the park. I guess they were 16. And I remember being 16. And I honestly didn't see a single band shirt. I didn't see a single punk rock kid, a single nothing. And it was just uniform. And these were not kids in uniforms. They were, we were just sitting eating our lunch. And I was like, fucking hell, is this? What the fuck? And then, it was not a surprise to me. But yet, as you say, there are perhaps other measurements which might say that young people are more interested in these small niche subcultures. Just somehow doesn't really feel like that, or like even in knowing my own cousins and my own relatives or stuff, and you find like music is a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh interest. A bunch of things, but the world is much more complicated, I think,
That's true. I mean, there is a lot of there's a lot of ways to spend your time and your money, and people have to pick and choose. What you're describing could have been my high school, except there would have been me and maybe one of my friends, wearing a Motorhead shirt or something. But that's growing up in the 90s in the, in the suburbs too. So, I think there's a lot of when there are perceptions of what was popular at a given time or how popular it was at a given time versus, that same thing now. There's so many personal associations and personal experiences that inform those perceptions. So again, it's like, I don't know how to measure this stuff.
I find it fascinating to think about and talk about. And also I'm perfectly aware that I'm a middle-aged man observing, things that are 20, 30 years. Tell me this, could another Perfect Day be the greatest Motörhead album ever?
Bop, no.
No?
No. That album for so many years.
I love it.
That was an underrated album for so many years, and now it has become an overrated album.
Ooh, controversial.
More recently, I think it's been kind of blown out of proportion. I would rank it somewhere in my personal Motorhead ranking. It would be in the middle third.
The middle third.
Somewhere below the overall halfway.
Me and Adi from Solstafir do these things where we go through, bands' discography and use middle-aged brains to try and decipher it all. And I had to listen to all of the Motorhead albums from the last 20, 30 years. And I realized after like Bastards, I like some of them, Sacrifice and a few others. But there's the last few or the last 6, 7, 8 records. And you're going, there's no rock and roll riffs. There's no, guitar nice flourishes. It's all gong, 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 gong kind of stuff,
Yeah.
They were almost all being the last third. But as I began to just filter my way through all the, just re-listen to everything again, I was just went, my God, Another Perfect Day has got some fucking, it's got to be in my top 3 or 4. I mean,
really?
What are the top few then for you, seeing as I'm completely
Overkill,
back of the conversation?
Yeah, Overkill, Bastards.
Bastards, you put so high?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Orgasmatron has aged really well, I think. Same for 1916. I mean, I love them all to a degree because I love the totality of it, right? And you don't have the totality of it without Kiss of Death and without Motorizer and maybe the less exciting ones. I mean, even the debut, I think, is one of the less exciting ones. I prefer those songs on Parole. I mean,
Rock and Roll is where I entered with Motorhead. That's the year that I started to first listen to 87.
Yeah, 1916 is where I entered. So
okay. I think Rock and Roll is a great record.
Rock and Roll's pretty good. It's got a little bit of filler. I'd rank that. It's in the middle of third, but it's above Another Perfect Day.
I see. Okay. Because me and Adi were discussing it and we just came to some staggering conclusion. We're like, this could be in my top 2 or 3 records. Could be,
Well, I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I don't agree.
I'm just trying to derail my mental processes of trying to analyze the anthropological, behavioral, cultural, social, digital instincts of young people and sort of kind of realize that I talked myself into a bit of a quagmire there,
Well, that goes to show what I often say is that all roads lead to Motorhead.
There you go. I think that's
And if they don't, you're probably fucked.
Yeah, no, you're probably wrong. So what's going on now next for this year?
This year is going to be a bit of a different year. High Spirits has a show in Chicago next month. After that, we're taking a little break, 6 months, maybe 8 months, because we're doing some shows with another band with some of the same people, which is Dawnbringer. Which broke up. We were never really together, so we never really broke up. But we ended that band in 2016. But recently had a few tempting festival offers. Almost said yes last year. I'm glad we didn't, because it's much easier to focus on this year without it being kind of in the middle of everything that was going on last year. So we're doing 4 shows. One for each point of the compass in the U.S. We're doing a northwest, east, and south. So one a month. There'll be a lot of flying, a lot of hotel lobby rehearsing probably. Yes. But it'll be good. It'll be good. I mean, we've played those songs. I mentioned we have like a Professor Black band that we do shows with sometimes, and so we've played some of those songs somewhat recently, but not as Dawnbringer. Which is how we're doing it this year. Then after that, some recording projects that have been kind of sitting on my hard drive unfinished for too long.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. I feel like on one hand, I feel like I should just walk away. But on the other hand, I feel like that I won't be able to start on anything new until I do finish them. So
do you ever feel like that almost? Sometimes I feel like that where it feels like people could do with a bit less of me.
Yeah. I feel like I could do with less of me sometimes.
Yeah. There's many of my friends would agree with the same thing, but just doing the podcast and constantly, putting stuff out. And then, I really enjoy doing the podcast and it's been a lot of fun. It was part of my coping mechanism with lockdown and stuff, But a part of me goes, dude, you need, maybe you should go dark for 6 or 9 months and like go and fucking live in an island and learn a trade or a craft or something and come back with a bit less fucking digital clutter in your head. Because it certainly does seem that people do get, they can be a bit overwhelmed by. I mean, I was reading this thing that they're saying that at the moment, I think 100,000 new tracks go up on Spotify every week. And by April, May, they expect it to reach 250,000 to 300,000. And that includes metal and death metal and every kind of metal as well.
Of course. Yeah.
Just an overwhelming deluge of music. And you kind of go to yourself, well, I mean, am I just adding too much to the overall clutter, the noise, you know? That was me shoveling things into it.
Yeah, shoveling clutter. You got a nice clutter shovel there.
Good name for a band.
Yeah, clutter shovel.
Yeah. But do you think we should start that project? Do you feel like sort of turning the volume down on yourself a bit for a while?
Yeah. Yeah, always. Yeah. I mean, as I get older, the less ego becomes less of a thing the older I get. I think for a few years, maybe I was a little overactive. What's the word that I want? A little
too eager or something?
Yeah, just a little too over assertive, maybe. Trying to get some attention for what I was doing, and then maybe 10 years ago, you know, that attention comes and, you know, it feels good. And, you know, I feel like, okay, you know, I wasn't crazy. Like, you know, this music I'm making is, you know, is connecting with people and, you know, has value. And I feel more recently as though I've come out on the other side of that I've gotten that kind of fulfillment and that kind of satisfaction. And now I'm just, it's not that I don't have other motivations. There have been other motivations, you know, creative motivation, artistic motivation, if you want to be as bold and call it that. And those motivations remain. So I've lost track of the question. But
I think it's just the as you said, sometimes you feel like maybe you I sometimes feel like wonder like 6 or 9 or 12 months off, so to speak. Would you come back with a better energy or that kind of thing? Because one of the things I've sort of felt is that now approaching a certain age, that you have to realize that the body of your creative youth or even the body of your creative work is most likely behind you, and that you're looking in the rearview mirror at the memories you've accumulated as a band, and that however many more years there is, 5, 10 more, I don't know, whatever, you're in the last few chapters, and it's sort of making peace with the fact that, as you say, you've come out the other side.
Yeah.
Not that it's over. Some people don't think about it at all, but like, you know.
Right. No, I'll be honest, and it's not a fun topic to talk about, but
no, it's not.
During the pandemic, I was very depressed.
Tell me about it.
Creatively, especially, I didn't record any music during the pandemic.
I didn't do anything. Nothing
that was finished. You know, like I said, I have some unfinished stuff on my hard drive, and one of the reasons it's difficult to think of going back and finishing it is because it's got that kind of depressive, like, stink on it. You know, it's still down there. It's down in that hole where I was. That's where that music is. But putting that aside, I think the low point of that creative depression was kind of accepting what you're talking about in a way, accepting that maybe there wasn't anything left. Not that the best was behind me, but that the entirety might be behind me. That maybe I was moving into a new phase, not as a musician, but just as a person. Maybe I was moving into a new phase of my life. And a funny thing happened after that. After I had kind of accepted and meditated on that possibility, accepted that might be true, that's kind of when the sun came back up again. And I could kind of imagine imagine a future and see a future creatively. And that kind of turned me back around. And since that, you know, since that pendulum swing or whatever, I'm cautious of looking at things the way you described, that there might be a finite amount of time remaining in the future. No, I don't, since turning that corner, I don't choose to see it that way. I just kind of, like I said an hour ago, I want to write the songs that I'm in the mood to write.
I mean, I think it's a healthier way
to look. I hope so. It's at least more functional, less despairing.
I mean, it doesn't fit generally with my worldview. I'm not sure I can shrug that stuff off, but I certainly think it's healthier. I mean, it's not lost. It's just the way I think about things, but it's not lost on me because we were shown a certain way the world could be, and that was where you don't, like, say next month, we'll play in Thessaloniki in Athens, and it's 20 years almost since the first time we went there. And a part of me will go, how many more times do you do this? And that's unfortunately that moment of lockdown and pandemic. It's become easier, but it's very difficult for me to shake off that the idea that this could all be closed and shut down.
It'll be taken away again. And I understand. And I'm not closing my eyes to that either. No. But I'm, you know, personalizing it more, you know, and applying it to myself as a creative, as a songwriter. That will only be taken from me if I allow it to be.
I mean, I said it during the lockdown. If this doesn't move on, let's say, you know, hypothetically, I wouldn't make any more heavy metal. I mean, heavy metal for me is about being in the room with other people.
Yeah, yeah.
Live, traveling. If there's no traveling and playing live and rehearsing, I won't make any more music, you know, or at least more heavy metal music. To me, the process, the human outcome at the beginning and the end is what justifies it in its sense. You know, I could see my
collective experience. Yeah.
I could see making harsh industrial noise or something strange like that, you know? But then again, I don't know whether anybody would really want to be listening to that.
Well, everything that's ever been popular is popular now.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is only whether that's ever been popular. And I don't know.
I'm not sure the world needs a Alan Averill Throbbing Gristle tribute band or something, you know, that might be too much for everybody. But
I know what you mean about touring and doing gigs and stuff. And I think for maybe for somewhat different reasons, I've gotten mixed feelings about that future. But that's more, again, that's for different reasons. I think that's maybe more for and we would need to do a part three to really get into that. But I'd say that's more for professional reasons on my end, that I have mixed feelings about it. I have mixed feelings about investing the time in that way and how sustainable that remains in the future. But as far as the art, the art of what we do, like I said, since since hitting that rock bottom, I've kind of rebounded and have a much better view of the future than I did for a little while there.
Well, I think that's a good moment to finish this part in this podcast on, because I think that's what comes through certainly in High Spirits. You know what I mean?
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it certainly does. Even for a cynical old bollocks like me, I mean, when I stick it on, it gives me a smile, and certainly the last couple of minutes of you describing it there is like, yeah, that's what I get from it. And certainly, like I said, while watching the band, and then where were we? I think we were at the Cirith Ungol thing or something like this. Remember?
In California?
Yeah.
We played with, we played with them in Houston too. Were you at Hell's Heroes that year?
No, I wasn't in Hell's Heroes.
Okay. Yeah, it must have been California.
Sidetracked by my own bad memory. But the point was that to watch the people I was with who didn't know the band at all get infused with exactly what you just said, I was like looking at them going, well, there we go. That's how it works, you know?
It's a real thing. It's a real thing.
Well, sir, it's been my pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks. We finally got it done after a couple of years.
No problem. Do it in person next time. We'll do a part three about the apocalypse of the touring industry. We can do that part three some other time.
That's good. I think we'll have much more common ground there.
Very possible. All right, sir.
Cool. Take care.
Aye, aye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.